Welcome to the Climate Diplomacy Podcast, a podcast from the Berlin-based Think and Do Tank Adelphi, bringing you the latest insights and debates in international climate diplomacy and security. We are your hosts, Raquel Monayer.
And I'm Alexandra Steinkraus. In this series, you will hear from experts and practitioners offering their take on climate foreign policy, climate-related impacts to security, and promoting peace and resilience in a changing climate. For more information, please visit climate-diplomacy.org or follow at climatediplo on Twitter.
Today's guest is Peter Schwarzstein. He's an environmental consultant and a think tanker with an impressive record on reporting. And Peter's work focuses predominantly on Eastern Mediterranean, Middle East, North and East Africa. And he writes about regional environmental and geopolitical issues, particularly on water, the climate conflict nexus that we know very well here in the podcast, and food security. He's a prize journalist, and his work is published in several media outlets like the National Geographic, Foreign Policy, BBC, New York Times, The Guardian, Foreign Affairs, Politico, Le Monde Diplomatique, and the list goes on. Welcome, Peter.
Thank you very much. I'm delighted to be here.
Yeah, and beyond this work as a journalist that I've mentioned, you also have been doing other work like consulting for international organizations, and you're also a research fellow, right? Tell us a little bit about this aspect of your work.
Absolutely. Like a lot of people, I have sort of fingers jammed into more pies than I could possibly imagine, and perhaps more than I could justify in some instances. But yeah, I do a kind of different forms of work, all pertaining to climate security and environmental security, just in different guises. So I started off as an environmental correspondent, mostly for National Geographic. And then after about 5 or 6, 7 years, predominantly focused on climate and environmental security in a media sense, I started transitioning part-time at least into doing similar-ish forms of work for various international organizations like the UN Environment Programme, like Human Rights Watch, like UNICEF. Part of that is related to reasons that we might end up talking about at greater length later in the episode. The sheer difficulties of conveying climate and environmental security talking points in a media setting. And in some instances, that made me feel that if there were stories or tales that I wanted to tell related to climate and environmental security, then it was best to do so for a research institute, best to do so for an international organization rather than the magazines that I would ordinarily work for. And the other, of course, is was a sort of purely motivation. The nature of media, as many people know, is that the business model of journalism is essentially broken. And so one could just do some of the same sort of work for slightly less ridiculously minimal sums of cash as one often were, even for the New York Times, even for National Geographic. So yeah, these days I do bits and pieces of kind of feature journalism writing, the kind of world in which I started off, a fair bit of consultancy work for these different organizations, and bits and pieces related to the two think tanks in Washington that I'm affiliated with, the Wilson Center and the Center for Climate and Security.
Now, that's interesting because we talk a lot about breaking the silos between organizations and bodies in the UN system. Breaking the silos is a very typical expression for the UN system, right? But this is also a way of breaking silos by working together with media and with research. You are able to give perspective for a research organization, for example, that they wouldn't have otherwise because these are seen as separate. So I find that an interesting position to be in. And you spoke about Wilson Center, and you recently also wrote an article for the Wilson Center's blog, The New Security Beat, which we follow here in Adelphi quite closely because it has a lot of interesting content. And that blog was on the use of environmental protection as a means to assert sovereignty over contested border regions. I thought that was a very interesting piece because we know from peacebuilding work that turning contested areas, these contested border areas, into these natural havens is often used as a strategy to neutralize conflict over territories, right?
Yeah, so this is a kind of real case in point of a phenomenon of an article or a story idea that likely would have been seen as too niche to interest a newspaper or a magazine for reasons that I simply wouldn't agree with, but that's the nature of how things are. And I saw this kind of phenomenon as a slightly grim or pessimistic counterpoint to these cross-border peace parks that we've seen emerge in a number of different parts of the world, including Southern Africa and South America in recent years. And in over this sort of decade or so of kind of mostly on-the-ground reporting in the Middle East and Africa further afield, I noticed this sort of steady growth protected areas in conservation areas along disputed frontier areas. And I was looking to explain a little more as to why they're there, the potential pitfalls that could emerge from their very existence, and just, yeah, expound a little bit on a phenomenon that didn't seem to have attracted much interest in any setting in recent years.
Yes, and I'll also link to this piece, and I feel like it's an interesting one for our listeners because we're looking at the future, solving the climate, environment, biodiversity crisis. There will be more interest in pushing for protected areas, so this will come up more and more. And now from another perspective a little bit, so we have environmental workers and also journalists like you that are reporting on the environmental and the climate crisis, already having to deal, of course, with hostile work environments. And we have now a very sad and recent example of the kidnapping of Iraqi environmentalist Jassim al-Assadi, I don't know if I'm saying his name right, last week, I think so, being the latest only of an unfortunately growing series of violence against people who are speaking up, or just sometimes they're simply just working on environmental protection. And this expansion of these militarized natural areas will not make things easier, right?
Absolutely not. So yeah, Jassim al-Assadi, as you mentioned, is a close friend of mine. He has spent much of the last 10, 15, a little bit more than that, years working for the protection of the marshes in southern Iraq, his native area. And on Wednesday last week, as you mentioned, he was detained by an armed group. The details are still a little bit murky. I, along with many others, have spent a lot of the last few days trying to work out precisely what's happened and lobbying in an array of ways for his safe release. However, as murky as it is, it does seem as if his plight is in some way connected to that pretty vociferous, impressive environmentalism that he's exhibited. And yeah, you're quite right to say that his experience is just a kind of a grim extension of that of so many other environmental defenders across the world. Almost every year for the past decade, more environmental defenders have been killed than the previous year. And so the Middle East, the area in which I work more than in others, has until relatively recently been something of an exception to that. You don't have anywhere near the same number of environmentalists killed or kidnapped or things like that in a way that you do in perhaps parts of Latin America or parts of Southeast Asia or parts of South Asia. But unfortunately, that is slowly changing. And for reasons that I say boil down as much to self-interest and also kind of concern for the plight of my friends and colleagues in the region, I've ended up getting quite enmeshed in lobbying and activism on the part of environmental defenders precisely because of that increased risk. And precisely because of the sheer number of absolutely tremendous local conservationists like Jassim who keep on suffering on account of their work. I'm a dual US-UK citizen, and as a consequence, I have a degree of protection working in these settings that many Iraqis like Jassim and many others within the region lack. And as a consequence, I really feel compelled to do whatever I can to try and help them in these sorts of situations.
Yeah, this is very unfortunate, particularly knowing that he was protecting the marshes, which is such a crucial ecosystem for the region that has been pretty much destroyed in the 80s. And today there's very little left of it, but still very relevant for people's livelihoods. So it's an important work that he's doing. And you're right, this dimension of violence against environmental defenders is different for at least what I'm used to listening from Latin America, Southeast Asia, like you mentioned, with the violence actors being others, right? Coming from the private sector, from sectors like the extractive sector, logging, large-scale cattle farming, mostly when we think of Amazon forests. But this seems to be a bit different. This seems to be more on government or on militia side. It seems to be different. So now my question to you is, you having worked as an environmental journalist and being on the road in these countries that are often plagued by conflict, oftentimes long-term. How have you perceived this? Because, of course, it's always a dangerous context to be in if you're close to a conflict. But also beyond this risk of being just accidentally caught in a dangerous situation, did you feel imminent danger of actually being a target yourself?
Yes, and this is one of these occasions in which I hope my mother doesn't deign to tune in. But even though, as I said, a kind of degree of difficulty that I've experienced is in most instances a fraction of that of my local colleagues with their less powerful passports. Over the past decade or so, yeah, I have had a lot of quite grim experiences. I had a kidnapping attempt in Syria in 2014 and a kidnapping attempt in Iraq in 2015. And I also got some shrapnel from an artillery shell in the back of my head in Iraq in 2016. So in most instances, these issues were largely unconnected from the environment itself or from environmental issues per se. But the thing that I've tried in my own small way to contribute to the kind of wider climate and environmental security field in this period is a kind of greater understanding of how environment and conflict, climate and conflict actually play out on the ground in places like Iraq, Syria, Sudan, where violence is often a kind of a grim reality of daily life. And in order to do that, it's required me to spend pretty extended periods of time, really much of the past decade, in these countries. And the longer you're there, the greater your exposure to the same difficulties that the average man or woman are experiencing on a day-to-day basis. Now, for the most part, as I said, as a foreigner with privileged passports, I'm guaranteed a greater degree of protection. But then also there are occasions where, as a foreigner, some people will see me as someone with sort of dollar signs on my back or a potential political pawn. So, yes, it's complicated. There's one thing I want to just pick up on that goes back to one of your slightly earlier comments, which is you're 100% correct to say that the threats to environmental journalists and environmental defenders in the Middle East and North Africa are mostly coming from the governments themselves or their proxies rather than the private sector. But I think it's pretty interesting to look at why that is happening, aside from the kind of relative absence of non-energy extractive industries within these regions. And that's because as climate change becomes that bit more debilitating and that bit more obvious, a lot of states in the region, like Iran, like Iraq, like Egypt, are waking up to the potentially destabilizing potential of climate change. So, for example, in Iran, we've seen quite a few protests related to water shortages over the past 4 to 5 years. And the nature of those protests has panicked the hell out of the Iranian regime. They see these different political constituencies, liberals with Islamists, people who would ordinarily not necessarily agree on that many things, merging in the streets and sharing that kind of same degree of anti-regime fury. So increasingly, this is seen as an issue that has the ability to mobilize massively divergent constituencies. And as a consequence, a lot of these environmental groups, these environmental defenders who work on these issues, have been reevaluated and increasingly perceived as extremely dangerous potential threats to regime stability. In Iran, that's very much the case, and to an ever-growing extent in places like Iraq and Egypt and Turkey as well.
Yeah, so I guess in the same way that it's difficult for us to completely separate climate change, environmental change, degradation from conflict and dynamics of conflict, or I guess the point that we're getting at is that it's also difficult to differentiate to what extent this will affect environmental defenders or journalists. So this brings us again to this climate conflict connection. And a lot of the work that we do, at least in our work in Adelphi, in our daily work, pertains to this weaving of narratives that allow for the international community to understand how climate change, environmental degradation, impact conflict and violence in the end. And we do this generally through demonstrating the pathways and breaking it down, because sometimes it's not so visible how one gets to the other. So there's so many intermediary factors happening there. And also these intermediary factors touch upon different stakeholders and have also different entry points to solve. And this is how we go about it. But I guess the question here is, you've been working on this for a while and following it there from the ground, from oftentimes much closer than we actually see things from our desk research perspective. How has this narrative shifted since you started working on these topics?
I think when I first started out in this sort of world about a decade ago, practitioners within the climate security community felt a lot more need to prove that climate change was a contributor to violence and instability and conflict. And while I think everybody at Adelphi and further afield would agree that there's a lot more work to be done, the degree of skepticism has certainly decreased dramatically. And that's wonderful. I think it's a shame that it's taken quite as long as it did. But to my mind now, perhaps the big narrative shift is an understandable desire on the part of policymakers for two things. One is a better understanding of precisely how climate change contributes to instability and violence and conflict. There's a greater appreciation that it's a factor, but they, again, understandably want an improved understanding of the precise pathways in which one gets from kind of climate change X to conflict Y. And the second thing is solutions. And as I think any of us who work in this wider world would readily admit, that second one is difficult in the extreme. I mean, in my own kind of low-level capacity, I'm often asked by Western diplomats working in the Middle East and Africa and further afield what they and the kind of donor-giving folks within their governments should do about climate risks. And on a certain level, I struggle because, as we know, climate security is basically the kind of the marriage of climate stresses and climate shocks with poor governance. And if there's a limit, as much of the time there is, if there's a limit to the amount that you can do to adapt or mitigate climate stresses and shocks themselves, then you're kind of left dealing with the poor governance angle, which is something that policymakers, both within these countries and donors outside, have spent decades already wrestling with. So if the kind of solutions that you're inclined to come up with are things like reduce corruption or improve governance, that's just so useless and unhelpful as to be trite in the extreme. This is the point where we come to environmental peace building, which is, to put it extremely simply and extremely unnuanced way, the optimistic flip side of climate and environmental security. Like, in the same way as people like us look at the ways in which climate change can contribute to tearing people apart, this is this sort of nascent but growing field looking at the ways in which environment can theoretically bring people together. Now, this is for the sake of my own sanity more than anything else. I'm kind of looking to move a little bit more into environmental peace building, like just looking at the ways in which climate and environment are contributing to misery is something that's dispiriting in the extreme if you're doing it on a day-to-day basis. And so I'm looking to educate myself as swiftly as I can on environmental peace building practices, just to sort of preserve my last tatters of sanity, if nothing else. No, there has been this dramatic and, for the most part, positive shift among people who need to be convinced within states, within major institutions, that climate change poses security risks. But now we just need to address those sort of the next questions that naturally arise from appreciation.
You're right. And I think this is a point that we almost inherently organically stumble upon when we're here on the podcast or anywhere, basically, when we're talking about climate security. We were this community of people who are working on the climate conflict nexus, right, which is a very large one at this point. All of us together with states that have been well engaged, including in developing countries or even least developed countries, quite an inclusive process, actually, something I didn't expect a few years ago. If you would ask me if it would be like this, I wouldn't have imagined to have so many states that are often on the back burner taking leadership. And that's a great part. But I do feel like this convincing phase has been more or less successful. And at this point, we've already caught the attention that everyone that we could, and the ones that we didn't probably are the ones that we can't anymore, more or less to this extent. But then we come to this point, right? Time to solve it. How can we do it to address the security impacts of climate change, or of anything else for that matter, of not enough education, of not enough health, of anything that is contributing to insecurity, without addressing all these fragilities on the way? And none of them are new, I guess, for the actors. And if you're talking about Iraq, we have here rampant corruption, destructing social cohesion in communities. You have to address that. And I feel like sometimes for states, it's like, that's not what I wanted to hear. I thought there was some solution. And unfortunately, it's the same. We have to address these things. What we're doing here is just pressing. I don't know if you agree, but we're making the addressing of these issues more pressing by highlighting how they connect with things that perhaps people didn't realize were connected beforehand.
Exactly. No. And in fact, I could almost see the disappointment in the eyes of some of the diplomats who I speak with, because a lot of them attracted to climate change is an issue, certainly speaking within the context of Western and perhaps some East Asian diplomats working in Africa and the Middle East, because they know that they can interest many of their bosses back in their national capitals in something that relates to both security and climate change, this sort of big, sexy issue with lots of money attached to it. And then when you look to get across to them that, as important as this subject is, there are still no easy solutions, and you're still left grappling with the same disregard for human rights, the same extremely poor quality of governance, of corruption that you originally had, and that these two are among the kind of solutions to this kind of new sexy challenge that you're wrestling with. You can really see their heads begin to drop. But yeah, just because something is unpleasant doesn't make it any less important and any less vital to tackle.
Yes, and the fact that this is still a surprise, something that is on the one hand so obvious and on the other hand still a surprise, really brings home how much, okay, we managed to convince people that climate brings security threats with it, climate change, but people are not aware of how yet policymakers also, which explains why they're asking for solutions. And you're now writing a book about this climate conflict connection, about the house, the heat and the fury. The title, I like that very much, I must say. And you're drawing upon a decade of experience reporting from the ground on how climate change fuels conflict and violence, from, I quote, urban crime to old school piracy to warfare. So maybe you can tell us a little bit more about it.
I'm extremely happy to plug this beast. Yeah, it turns out it's much more fun talking about writing a book than actually writing a book, as I'm currently finding. But this book. It's a general interest book. It's a trade book. It's not an academic book. And the idea is to sort of introduce to a much wider public than climate security has generally enjoyed up till this date, the nature of what's going on. So over 10 or so chapters, I'll be looking at 10 different countries in which 10 different manifestations of climate change and non-climate environmental problems are contributing to instability and violence. And all of this is grounded in my own research over the past decade or so. And the idea is to show through the prism of kind of afflicted characters, farmers, soldiers, spies, scientists, and a whole bunch of others, how climate change is merging with other political and economic and social complications to contribute to greater instability and kind of violence in their lives and those of their communities and those of their states. And I think many of us would agree that this is a field that until relatively recently had been largely the preserve of kind of academic and security circles. So this is meant to be, and really hope it will serve as something of a kind of a primer for people well beyond these circles, but also by approaching climate change from a little bit more of a kind of security or military angle than one would ordinarily see in the kind of general interest or trade book section, to also reel in a bunch of new readers who are not necessarily drawn to climate change when it's discussed in the ways that it previously largely has been. So looking at it through the lens of migration or social justice or human rights. By coming at this from a slightly more violent perspective, that's not quite the right way of putting it, but a slightly more kind of militaristic perspective, I'm hoping to reach a bunch of people who just previously haven't engaged much with the climate discourse at all.
And that's crucial, because if there's one thing that this community is not good at, is bursting the bubble and communicating outside of the bubble. We're all constantly preaching to the choir and putting together all this knowledge, this wealth of knowledge on how things connected in this region and in that region, but it's only staying inside. So I'm very excited about this, and it can be great. I also feel like perhaps there could be some lessons in there about how the community itself can start communicating a little bit more outside of the bubble. And now I'm thinking of our listeners, many of who are also working in this intersection, right, between climate, peace, and security, often working on analysis and reports on the subject, perhaps even thought leaders that could even have a considerable role in shaping the climate security discourse. How do you believe your book will contribute to this discourse?
So I think part of it is that both I and I think, again, maybe more or less everybody who works in this field has been approached by policymakers and others in the past and told, listen, we need more examples. We need a better understanding of precisely how climate change is contributing to violence and grim scenarios on the ground. We were talking earlier about how we appear to have mostly won the argument about the nature of climate change's existence as a contributor to instability. Now we're in that next step. And in this respect, I hope that through 10 detailed chapters worth of descriptions, I can impress a little bit more upon the people who need to be impressed, the ways in which climate change is just inveigling its way into the daily lives of people who are already struggling from grim arrays of other kind of political and social and economic drivers of instability, and thereby just making it even more likely that these sort of complicated situations spill into bloodshed. So that's part of it. It's just trying to lay out 10 or so pathways. The second is to move a little bit off the beaten track. Like a lot of the time, and this goes back to the publisher's blurb that you mentioned at the beginning, like a lot of the time when we talk about climate-related violence and instability, we look at Syria and Iraq, we look at the Sahel, we look maybe at Afghanistan or one or two other places, and certainly a few of those.
Or the typical farmer-herder conflicts, right?
Exactly. And I don't necessarily shy away from that. I do have at least two or three chapters that kind of play into some of those geographic settings. But most of the book is looking at some of the much less covered ways in which, usually in a much lower, less kind of headline-grabbing way, in which climate change and non-climate environmental problems are fueling violence in people's lives. For example, in rural Bangladesh, I spent a few months looking at the ways in which sea level rise was contributing to piracy within the kind of inland waterways of the Sundarbans. Now, this is a very different form of piracy to what we've had off the coast of Nigeria and Somalia. This is a form of piracy in which the kind of water bandits basically prey on local fishermen and villagers alone, like being very careful to steer clear of well-dressed Bangladeshi tourists or foreigners. In Nepal, I'm in Kathmandu. I've got one chapter looking at the ways in which climate change is fueling these extremely exploitative water tanker mafias within the poorer districts of the city. So these are the kind of much less sexy, much less extreme forms of kind of violence and instability than kind of conflict and terrorism, but that are nevertheless still making the lives of tens of millions of people, if not more, even more difficult than they previously were. To go back to your initial question, and I may very well beg to be brought back onto the podcast in the summer of 2024 when this book is likely going to be published and when I'm supposed to be whoring myself out to my heart's delight to sell it. But really, yeah, it's trying to shed a little bit more light on the precise pathways from climate change to violence or instability, while also just providing a whole bunch of new case studies for us to get our teeth into as a community.
Absolutely interesting. We'd like to have you back, definitely, also on our platform. Very good.
Maybe one last sort of book-related comment, which is to say that this is not meant to be an exhaustive study of climate security as a field. First of all, it's far too big for, I think, one person to fully get their teeth into. And secondly, even if it weren't, I wouldn't necessarily be the right person to do that. I don't have the same theoretical background in parts of the science as many of my scholarly colleagues within the climate security world do. But the thing that I'm, I guess, trying to do is play to my strengths, like an understanding of how these situations play out on the ground. And so, yeah, this book, I hope, will be both educational, but also ideally readable and fun. Well, fun within the parameters of something that is quite grim subject matter.
The possibility allows.
Exactly.
Well, I've read many of your blogs and articles, and I always find them enjoyable to read. So I'm sure the book will be as well. And also, no one has all the angles, right? No one has all the examples. And that's why we have to be a community and work together and enrich each other with our different perspectives and experiences. You have a very important role to fulfill, I'm sure. We all do, hopefully. At least I like to think I'm fulfilling some role here too.
Yeah, you are for sure. No, it's always lovely to come across you at various conferences. And I think you know more about this than the vast majority of us.
Yeah, we have been doing very specific work on climate and security in our program at Adelphi. And as you were talking about these maybe less sexy examples, it made me think of the Climate Security Expert Network, where we had all these kind of risk briefs that were put together for different regions. And we had, for example, some that you wouldn't think about, at least I didn't at the time, of how Pacific Islands are being affected by climate insecurity. But how? In which way? Immediately we think of sea level rise and migration. But it turns out that migration between islands is not necessarily a very big, I mean, it's an issue, it's a human security issue, but not like a conflict issue necessarily, because there's a great culture of islanders from other are receiving the people who are being displaced by sea level rise and weather, right? So they have this culture of opening their homes and communities for people that were displaced, and therefore there's no conflict in that side. But then you have climate change moving the fisheries or the fishes to other economic zones, which might create diplomatic, quite tense situations between the Pacific Islands and other big economies, China, US. So things I never thought about, to be honest, because as we say, it's not the Sahel, it's not the typical farmer-herder conflict, which are definitely still worth talking about because they're so pressing. But still we have all these other things. Or also, like you mentioned in your blurb about urban crime, what's connected to it. I come from Latin America, and in Brazil, at least, in my country, definitely it's a factor. People moving away from places where they could have a livelihood before can't anymore. It's not necessarily a super new thing, but it does get more pressing with time. And then being pushed into cities just to be marginalized. And of course, this increases the situation of urban crime, right? When you have marginalization. So all these things being connected, I didn't really understand that in the past, but we're coming closer to step by step, understand the how. And this how is super important for the let's do something about it. So thanks a lot for this. Also, thank you for coming.
Thank you very much for having me.
Today I spoke to Peter Schwarzstein. He's an environmental journalist and a researcher with a lot of on-the-ground experience in countries such as Iraq and Syria, working on the intersection between climate change and conflict. We spoke about how states often put contested border areas under protected status as a way to claim sovereignty over them. He also told us a bit about the dangers of environmental journalism and the kind of risks environmental workers are confronted with in regions such as the Middle East. Peter also gave us insight into his upcoming book, The Heat and the Fury, which will look into 10 more or less known cases of climate-related insecurity.
His book, which is expected for summer 2024, will attempt to bring a narrative on the climate conflict connection that bursts the bubble and reaches broader audiences, which, if you ask me, is a pretty tall order. But someone has to do this, so lots of luck to you, Peter. If you don't follow us on Twitter yet, please do so at Climate Diplo. Thank you for tuning in, and until next time, goodbye.